Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the January episode. I'm news editor Ezzy Pearson, and I'm joined on the podcast today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Coming up later today, we'll be telling you how you can see Orion in our stargazing tip of the month. But first, we're going to take a moment to talk about our January issue, which just so happens to also be our 200th issue. So we're all very proud that we've been going for, is it 16 years?
That's right.
The magazine's been going for now.
Sky at Night magazine launched with the June issue 2005, way back 16 years ago. And yeah, what a time it's been. 200 issues. I'm very pleased that we've been able in the 200th issue to include a double page spread on which we have every single one of our covers right back to the very first issue. It's just a mind-boggling sight, personally speaking, when you look back on it, seeing all those issues that we've created together. Mm. When did you join the magazine, Ezzy?
I joined, funnily enough, back on issue 100.
Issue 100?
That was the issue that was going on sale when I started. So for me, it's been particularly poignant.
Fantastic,
for me, it's my 100th issue.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's great to have been able to sort of be on the forefront of all of these like observations and scientific discoveries that's been happening. Because one of the things that we did in the issue was we had Chris Lintott, who's one of the presenters of the Sky at Night, write about all of the scientific, the biggest scientific discoveries that have happened over the 16 years that the magazine's been going. And some of them were really sort of, these things that you feel have been around for longer than 16 years. Like, for instance, back when the magazine started, we barely knew of any exoplanets. Now we know
right.
of thousands and thousands, and we're beginning to like get close views of them and understand what their climates are like and what they're made up of. And so that was kind of, you know, a really interesting shift to see.
The advances there have been incredible, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We've detected gravitational waves for the first time in detectors that hadn't even been built.
Yeah, it's a whole new chapter of astronomy, that, isn't it? That's just started in the past 15 years. Absolutely incredible. Mm. And I mean, personally, you say issue 100. I've been on Sky at Night magazine since issue one. Not as editor. I started out as the production editor, the sub-editor on issue one. So I can remember quite clearly putting that very first issue together. working on all those issues. I became the editor in issue 77 back in 2012. And being able to see all the covers just brought back some of the great things that we've covered since then, and some of the great things outside the magazine that we've been able to do as well. Things like the Total Eclipse event that we put on in March 2015 in Bristol.
Oh, yeah.
It was a total eclipse in some parts of the world. From the UK, it was the largest partial eclipse that we'll get to see for many, many years. And it really was. I think it was probably about 60-65% of the sun was covered by the moon. From Bristol, anyway. And we had hundreds of people turn up to the event in the morning. The sky was quite cloudy, but it cleared just at the right time for us to see the eclipse. So that was fantastic. The other thing we've done in the issue is we've got in touch with some. We found out that some of our subscribers have been reading the magazine since issue one. An amazing number, actually. 120 subscribers have been reading the magazine since issue one, which is just fantastic. And I think it we're so grateful to all our readers for following us for that long. We talked to just five of them, and here it was so interesting to hear their insight into the kind of astronomy they do, what they find interesting about the hobby, what keeps them going, and it's just a really unique insight into what gets people going about the hobby and about the science.
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic, and we're thankful to all our readers, and hopefully some of our listeners are readers as well. And so if you want to read more about what's been going on in the 200 issues of Sky at Night magazine, the discoveries that have been made, the observations that have happened, be sure to pick up our 200th issue. However, there is another landmark occasion that will be happening in mid-December, and that's on the 22nd of December, the James Webb Telescope is finally due to launch.
Finally, yes, after many
finally,
years.
Finally, this is, I say finally, because it was first supposed to launch back in 2007. That was its first launch date. It's a bit behind.
Yes, it is. There have been delays, haven't there? But it's a massively complex instrument, and mm-hmm. it's going to set the standard for astronomical observations in a way that Hubble did when it first launched.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's why the JWST, as it's also known, was first envisioned. It's meant to be a follow-up to the Hubble Space Telescope, but it's a very different animal. It's a infrared telescope. That means it can look through the dust in the universe, because dust is everywhere, and if you're looking visually, you can't see through it, but infrared can. There's no hoovers in space, exactly. And it's got a 6.5-meter mirror. And there's a problem when you have a mirror that big, which is that it won't fit in a rocket. Rockets are only about 3.5 meters wide, I think. That's the maximum width you can fit in there.
Can't fit it in. They couldn't fit it in, could they?
No, they are having to fold the mirror up. It's been constructed out of 18 hexagonal plates, all of
That's
which
right.
are very gently curved to create the mirror shape that you need. These are also coated in gold.
That's right. Yeah, they're gold plated, aren't they? It's very dramatic. It looks very dramatic, doesn't it? All these different segments are hexagonal too, so it looks a little bit like a kind of honeycomb, doesn't it, from a beehive?
It does. It very much looks like a beehive or a honeycomb. And the reason why it's gold rather than the usual silver that you see is because gold reflects infrared light much more effectively and much better.
Very good. That gold is a very thin micron thin plating. Mm. The vast proportion, the backing of behind that gold plating is beryllium, which is a very, very rare metal, isn't it? And actually, I was doing some reading up on beryllium. It's an absolutely fascinating element in terms of the particle physics, Ezzy, isn't it? I mean, I had no idea how it was formed. All elements heavier than iron, all the elements are formed in stars, aren't they? Thing, you know, fused together from hydrogen and helium.
All the ones up to iron, anyway.
Up to iron, but you can't get any heavier elements than that formed within a star. Every element in the periodic table heavier than iron is formed in a supernova, but not beryllium, which I just find it absolutely mind-boggling that it takes a supernova to form these heavy elements, and then some of these heavy elements are struck by cosmic rays. Just randomly struck by cosmic rays, and then that reaction goes on, and some of those elements that are formed from these cosmic ray strikes go on to create beryllium, which is just mind boggling. The kind of chances of this happening throughout the universe over time to create a metal. It kind of explains why it's so rare, I guess.
Yeah, so it is this incredibly rare metal, but it's also very light. It's number 4 on the periodic table, which means it's an incredibly lightweight metal, which is great if you're trying to build your spacecraft out of it. But it's also still strong. It's got all of the other properties that you want to have if you're making a mirror. And so that's why they sort out this incredibly rare metal to make these 18 hexagons out of.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and it's going to have quite a lot of instruments on board, isn't it, Ezzy?
There are 4 main instruments. There's a near infrared camera, a near infrared spectrometer, a mid infrared instrument, as it's called, or MIRI, and a near infrared imager, and what's called a slitless spectrograph. So a spectrograph gets in the light from distant stars or distant objects, and then sort of splits it up. And that allows you to, when you've got that sort of spectrum, you can see all of the different, what's called spectral lines. So these are when you've got a certain element in a star, it glows with a certain color of light, and you can pick out that color of light and be able to tell that element is in a star. And so you can begin to pick out what, you know, I say star, it could be an exoplanet, it could be something around a distant planet. We'll get more into what JWST is actually going to be looking at later. But it's got this entire suite of instruments that are going to be able to just really break apart what these planets, what these cosmic objects are like, and look at things that we just haven't had the capability to do before. Because this is the first big, really... We have had infrared telescopes before, but it's hard to put one on Earth because Earth's atmosphere just soaks up all of the infrared, and all you end up seeing is the Earth's atmosphere. So you need to put it above the Earth's atmosphere. And there has been various telescopes. They've been much smaller because they haven't had this massive 6.5-meter mirror. And they've also tended to be very focused on a specific part of the spectrum, looking at a specific thing. So things like Herschel and Spitzer, things like that. They were very sort of focused on a narrow range of things to be able to do. Whereas the whole point of the JWST is it's just going to be this kind of broad approach, looking at all of these different things, and just basically people can come up with whatever observation they want to do and apply for time. And I say they'll get it, but you know, it's incredibly in demand instrument.
I mean, the time is precious on JWST, isn't it? More so than Hubble. When you look at how broad the part of the spectrum is that the Webb telescope will be able to see, it's hugely wide. It covers over half of the spectrum towards the infrared end, which are the longer wavelengths of light. Of course, one of the things that helps the Webb telescope to be able to take such good observations and be able to see so much of the infrared part of the spectrum is the fact that it's going to be a huge distance from Earth. Hubble orbited the Earth 570 kilometers above the surface. The Webb telescope is not even going to be orbiting the Earth. It's launching on this huge Ariane 5 rocket up from French Guiana, from Spaceport Europe, ESA spaceport in French Guiana, which is in South America. It's going to travel 1.5 million kilometers away into deep space, and there it's going to be it's going to travel to a point in space known as the Earth-Sun Lagrange point, L2. Now, there are four of these Lagrange points around Earth, and at these Lagrange points, the gravitational forces of the Sun and Earth exactly balance the centrifugal force acting to carry objects further out into space. So, in effect, objects at these Lagrange points hover in a kind of stationary position in relation to the Sun and Earth without having to expend much fuel. Now, there are four of these. Two of them are on the orbital path of Earth, ahead of and behind our planet on its orbital path. One is in between the Sun and the Earth, and the second one, L2, where JWST is going, is on the far side of Earth from the Sun. And there, it's going to be far, far away from all the light from the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon, which will keep instruments cool. And as the other thing that JWST has built into it is this huge sun shield, which is going to block even more of the light from the Earth, Sun, and Moon, and keep its instruments incredibly cool, which is vital for taking infrared observations. I mean, it's just a different beast to Hubble. It really is. You know, as well as orbiting at a vastly greater distance from our planet, it's got this 21 meter wide sun shield, about the size of a tennis court, if you can picture that in your mind.
Absolutely huge.
It's huge, whereas Hubble was 13 meters in length, about the size of a coach or a small bus. We've already talked about the mirror. The mirror is going to be 6.5 meters in diameter, whereas Hubble's mirror was 2.4 meters in diameter, and so that gives the Webb telescope over six times the collecting area of the Hubble mirror, which is going to mean it collects more light, and it's going to be giving astronomers much greater resolution in terms of the observations that it can take. It's going to be able to see much finer detail. One interesting thing that I noticed was the difference in mass between the two instruments. Do you know anything about that, Ezzy? Which do you think is the heavier
that
one?
That is one of the kind of measurements I haven't actually looked at.
It's fascinating because I was expecting, you know, in terms of its size, it's a much bigger instrument. In actual fact, the Webb telescope is half the mass of the Hubble Space Telescope. Telescope comes in at 12 tons.
Wow.
The Webb telescope weighs 6.5 tons.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I mean, that's what you get for making your plates out of beryllium.
That's what you get. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But I don't know if any of our listeners at home have ever seen pictures. There's on the NASA website, they have lots of them where you can see sort of this absolutely enormous telescope next to the people who are working on it. And it gives you this kind of sense of scale of just how big it is. But it's, you know, as you said, you know, it's the size of a tennis court with this massive thing sticking up the side of as high as a house.
That's right, this giant thing. And it's going to be launching on December the 22nd, isn't it? So,
yes.
You know,
hopefully.
We do wish it well.
Hopefully we'll be launching on December the 22nd because it has had a bit of a a past and a bit of a history on the way to the launch pad. As I said, it began development back in 1996, meant to be a successor to Hubble, but a complementary one. And initially, its forecast was forecast to cost around about $500 million. I think at the end tally, it's more like $10 billion. So that's a bit of an increase in cost there.
that's quite an increase, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But it was originally supposed to launch in 2007, but it had a major redesign in 2005, at which point it was the launch date was pushed way back. It was going to be much more capable of what it could do, and much more advanced. Basically, it had been suffering from scope creep up until that point, where basically everybody said, it's like, oh, why don't we put this on? Why don't we make it do this? And in 2005, they sat down and said, okay, let's see what we can actually put on and go with that. The main construction finally finished in 2016, at which point it was going through testing. And this is where things really started going wrong. Because in March 2018, they were practicing deploying this absolutely massive sun shield. But there's one very small problem with a sun shield that is the size of a tennis court, but has the thickness of 0.05 millimeters. It's incredibly thin, and there's five of these sheets, and they all have to go out perfectly. And during this test deployment, it tore. And there was no way to kind of repair this other than sort of completely taking that layer off and putting it back on again. So that took another couple of years, and the launch date was suspended back to again. And then in March 2020, the pandemic happened. And they had to push back the launch date again to the 31st of October, because basically NASA decided that they really needed to sort of concentrate their resources that they had on things that were needed to go at a certain time. So, for instance, they were working on the Perseverance rover. That had to be ready by, when did that launch? August, because otherwise it was going to miss its launch window, whereas JWST can launch pretty much at any time.
It can launch at any time. I mean, it's not critical, is it? Because it's not having to kind of tie in with the orbital paths of different planets. And it's quite the scheduling. Yeah. I talk about kind of scheduling trains, scheduling stuff in terms of orbital dynamics and the motion of the planets is an order of magnitude more tricky than National Rail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So then the launch got pushed back to the 31st of October. Then in August, all the Ariane 5 rockets, which is what the JWST will be flying on, were grounded because there was an issue with their payload fairings. So that's basically the kind of the panels that go around your instrument to protect it during launch. So it got pushed back 3 months to the 18th of December. And then a couple of weeks ago for us, about a month when this comes out, in late November, something called a clamp band released whilst they were mounting this telescope on top of the rocket, and shook the entire telescope. And it must have been so, you know, you've got this $500 million telescope, $10 billion telescope that people have been waiting decades for, been going on and on about and making jokes about how delayed it is. And then you just suddenly see the entire thing go, ugh.
Ping. This one little, when you say clamp band, I'm imagining a kind of rubber band just pinging off it and flying off into the corner of some clean room.
I've been trying to discover what a clamp band actually is. And I think that is basically what happened. But fortunately, you know, the telescope was going to suffer much worse shaking during launch. So it was, they put in an extra couple days delay, just to, you know, check everything thoroughly and make sure everything was okay. And finally, on the 22nd of December, that is when it is due to launch. Finally.
Well, I think it's just as well that they're doing all these checks ahead of time and putting in these slight delays, because, of course, being that far away, 1.5 million kilometers out in space, there's, you know, you we can't service it in the same way that Hubble was able to be serviced
Absolutely.
By teams of astronauts. Mm-hmm. It's going to be out there. It has to, you know, there is no leeway for repair once it's out there. So
no.
We need, you know, all the kind of the global consortium of space agencies who are creating this amazing mission. They are all invested in it. They all want to make sure that it's absolutely going to work once it launches to space.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And unfortunately, one of the, because you mentioned Hubble again then, and one of the things that they were hoping they'd be able to do was have JWST and Hubble making observations at the same time of the same thing, so they could work together.
Yes.
And because of all of these delays, unfortunately now Hubble is not doing very well. It's constantly going into safe mode at the moment. Sort of every couple of months, I get a report in sort of saying Hubble's gone back into safe mode. And most of the time they can, you know, flick a couple of switches, turn it off and on again, and it works and it's fine.
They can do some software updates, can't they, on this thing and try and reboot their operating systems.
There's no space shuttle anymore, so they can't go and service it. So hopefully they'll be able to get, you know, at least a couple of months out of the two of them working together. I think they're hoping for a couple of years, but we'll have to see if that happens. But it is an exciting time because even by itself, the JWST, as we said, is a huge, like it's an incredible instrument. It's going to be able to observe all over the cosmos from our own solar system backyard, right the way out to, you know, the earliest objects that are out there. So the what's called the Cycle 1 observations have already been assigned. The first 6,000 hours of JWST time has already been assigned. There are small programs, which only are less than 25 hours to do, medium projects, which are 25 to 75, and large projects, which are 75 hours long. And there's dozens of these that have already been assigned, studying exoplanets and their disks around them. So this is going to be one of the big things that the JWST is going to be really good at, because it can look through the dust, it looks in the infrared, it can see these hot young systems, seeing them as they grow and really begin to sort of pick apart what's called the protoplanetary disks. So this is the disk of dust and debris that's around planets and pick out possibly even, you know, growing planets, perhaps even some growing moons, which is something that we're beginning to hear about in these disks of dust. Equally, it'll be looking at really early galaxies, seeing how these grow. Mm-hmm. Again, they tend to be quite dusty, so being able to see in that part of the spectrum will really helping this.
Yeah. Yes, talking about the first galaxies, we're talking about looking back in time to a very early period of the universe's history. The first galaxies formed around 300 million years after the Big Bang, and Hubble was able to see the kind of later stages of that period in the universe's history. JWST will be able to see much farther back into that period, and in fact, it will be able to see beyond that, further back into time again, back to when the first stars were being formed, and that really is something incredible to be able to see the very first generation, the very first population of stars, and how they were formed. And it's going to be fascinating to see how they're different from later stars that are formed these days.
Yeah, it's really looking into a lot of this kind of like very early, very distant galaxies, because again, it can look through the dust that fills the universe and get a much clearer picture of what's going on. So looking at things like the intergalactic medium, which is the stuff between galaxies, is sort of vague, like not even clouds, just this sort of wash of stuff.
The very tenuous, almost, it's almost a vacuum, isn't it? I mean, there's probably about one atom or one particle of matter, you know, in a huge volume of space, isn't there? We're talking in the interplanetary medium. But yeah, it's fascinating that it's going to be able to characterize that a little bit more. But what's it going to see in the solar system then, a bit closer to Earth?
So this is actually really very interesting. The Hubble Space Telescope is going to be looking at lots of the outer planets, Jupiter, mm-hmm. Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Won't be able to look inwards, unfortunately, because they're too close to the sun, basically.
Too much heat.
You've got this massive telescope that they've built a tennis court sun shield to protect it from the light of not just from the heat of not just the sun, but the Earth and even the moon, which is so bright.
Even the reflected light from these bodies is too much for it.
So it's only going to be able to look at. But that means it's going to be looking at these gas giant planets, which is going to be really fascinating because infrared is really good for looking down into planet atmospheres. So if you've got these thick atmospheres like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, they all do, that's what it's going to be able to start picking apart. It's going to be able to see some of these layers.
That's one of the things that excites me. I find one of the branches of astronomy that I'm particularly interested in is planetary science, and particularly in planetary science is these gas giants. What is under the visible surface of Jupiter? What is it like? Yeah. What is under the visible surface of Saturn? That kind of thing. I'm just so curious about that. And it's just, I'm in really keen anticipation of what we'll find out.
Yeah. It's whenever when you look at these planets, you realize they've got these layers where they have very romantic sounding things going on, like it rains diamonds and sapphires, the winds blow with rubies, and then you actually think about what that would be like, and it's horrific.
Yeah, pretty bad. Yeah, you'd need a pretty strong umbrella to kind of visit that place, wouldn't you? Interestingly, Uranus and Neptune are interesting targets as well. I'm really pleased that there has been some observation time allotted to those ice giants, because we have such a low resolution view of them, really, don't we? The only observations we have of them close up are thanks to the Voyager flybys in the late 1980s, and that's 3 decades ago. The kind of distant past nowadays in terms of the kind of technology and the capability of instruments. So it's high time that we discovered we put in some more time observing those worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because with the planets, you again have the problem of the Earth's atmosphere, but this time it's not just like removing the light like it does with infrared; it's moving the light. So as it comes through the Earth's atmosphere, it has a bit of a wobble to it, something called seeing, and that blurs the image of these distant planets, which is why Hubble did spend some time looking at that at Uranus and Neptune, but it only had a 2.5 meter mirror. It could still only detect so much on these planets. And even though there was like projects that sort of looked at extended periods of time, which I think the JWST is going to carry on. It's not just sort of taking like one snapshot of these planets and then moving on and never returning. It's going to sort of take different pictures at different times and sort of keep track of the planets as they move on. And that's one of those things of if we can get Hubble doing that at the same time in the visual light, because JWST does have some visual capability, but it's not its strong suit. It's much more of an infrared thing. So if we can get those two together for a bit, that's going to be some really interesting results and some stuff that because that's one of the things with the things that these big telescopes do is it's not necessarily just going and doing this one observation and that's done and that's that one project that's going on. It's creating this entire legacy of data that's open to everybody because it's a NASA instrument and NASA has this policy that any data that its instruments takes will be open to everybody.
Now it's time for the stargazing tip of the month.
The winter skies see the return of one of the most recognisable constellations, Orion the Hunter. The bright stars of Orion make it easy to find and are a great opportunity to teach younger astronomers about how to navigate the sky. First, locate the three bright stars in a row that form Orion's belt. You should then be able to see the four stars that mark the corners of a rectangle around the belt. The top two stars are called Bellatrix and Betelgeuse, marking Orion's shoulders. The bottom two stars are named Siph and Rigel and mark his feet. Orion offers an easy way to see the difference in colours between stars. Rigel, on the bottom right of the constellation, is blue-white in colour, while Betelgeuse, on the top left, is a distinct reddish-orange. This is because Betelgeuse is an older star heading towards the end of its life. It's run out of fuel and entered the red giant phase, where its outer layers cool and glow red. Meanwhile, Rigel is a massive star, burning its fuel very rapidly and getting white hot. If you fancy more of a challenge, then try to locate a line of stars hanging down off Orion's belt. This is the Hunter's Sword. Halfway down this sword, you may see that one of the stars looks a bit fuzzier than the rest. This is the Orion Nebula, also known as M42. If you have a pair of binoculars or a small telescope to hand, you should be able to see even more detail in this region. Though bear in mind, it won't look quite like the images you might have seen in the pages of Sky at Night magazine. Like all nebulae, these colours can only be pulled out by extensive image processing. To the eye, M42 looks like a pale, misty cloud, but don't let that put you off. There's nothing quite like being able to see a distant nebulae with your own eyes.
So that's it from us this month. Be sure to pick up our 200th issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also hear from readers who have been with the magazine since issue one, look back over the greatest scientific breakthroughs and landmark astronomical events that have occurred in the last 200 issues, and preview the biggest missions and observing events to come in 2022. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.